right, is everyone ready?
Hold on, I'm not.
Noah, are you ready? Jay, you ready?
Yeah.
All right.
Is it video?
No, it's not. It's just they're podcasts.
Oh.
People listen to them on their iPods.
I just want to make sure.
Awesome.
Okay, take two.
Good evening, and welcome to Theology Live, a podcast and live event that highlights the playful dance between theology and contemporary life. Our guest this evening is the Reverend Becca Stevens. Becca is the founder and president of Thistle Farms, the largest social enterprise in the U.S., run by survivors of human trafficking and the commercial sex trade. She is also the author of 13 books and works as an Episcopal priest and chaplain at my former home, St. Augustine's Chapel in Nashville. Becca is a force of nature, a compelling communicator, an audacious advocate, a visionary, mentor, and friend. I'm Meredith Day, Minister of Youth and faculty member at Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church and School, and this is Theology Live.
Nothing.
It's so fun to have you on the podcast tonight.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm so glad you're here. Okay, I know a lot of people in the room already know you, but some of people here do not know who you are and the work that you do. So I wonder if you will just start off by sharing a little bit about what life looks like for you right now in Nashville and on the road and why you're here at Calvary.
I'm here because they serve Boston cream pie. Every Lent for 90-something years, it's the best. And today, they ran out before we got down there. So I'm staying, and I'm going to preach again tomorrow and hope that they don't run out tomorrow. But Thistle Farms is a community of women who are survivors of trafficking, prostitution, and addiction. On average, the women that we serve are first rate between the ages of 7 and 11, and first hit the streets between the ages of 14 and 16 years old. And it was about 21 years ago we opened up the very first house and invited 5 women to come in and be a part of it. What we didn't know is we were starting a movement. And it's been an amazing, amazing journey to be a part of and watch. We have grown to be the largest justice enterprise in the U.S. run by women who are survivors. And we have 49 sister communities now throughout the United States and 27 global partners. We were just in Seattle 2 weeks ago, opening up a house for survivors in Everett, Washington. And their new director is one of the graduates of Thistle Farms. The house we opened up in Omaha is run by the executive director, a graduate of Thistle Farms in Nashville. And it's really fun to watch this. My life right now is like, I'm so beautifully surprised to see that without really a lot of religious structure or language, it seems like, you know, those are missionaries going out and spreading the word and leading the way it should be, where we are healing each other. I spend about half my time in Nashville and about half the time on the road raising money for other programs or hawking bath and body care products and books and, you know, going to beautiful faraway places and really sad faraway places and places pretty close to home, in and out of prisons and jails. We were this year out in the largest women's prison in Arizona, and the largest portion of women are Native American that are in that prison. And, you know, they are a reminder of all the work that still needs to be done and that women are still longing and dying for home.
And tell us about what was the genesis of Magdalene House, which then became Thistle Farms. You said 21 years ago. What did that look like, that initial step into Magdalene?
Well, that is going to be part of the video we show later. So if you're listening to this on the podcast, you have to go check out the video Love Heals. But what happened was I had known for a long, long time I wanted to start a sanctuary for women. I mean, since my dad was killed by a drunk driver when I was 5, and then the guy that stepped in, my dad was an Episcopal priest, stepped in to take over the small mission church that my dad had he began sexually abusing me. It went on for years. And I always knew that I really wanted to have a real sanctuary for women that was really safe where healing could happen. And I knew I wanted to be free, 2 years, no authority in the house, just that people could love each other and be together and find out what healing looks like for each individual person. I knew all that, but life gets busy. My husband had a country music deal with Columbia Records at the time, and he was on the road. I had a 4-year-old, and I was pregnant with our second one, and I was working part-time downtown, basically doing feeding programs for homeless folks. And the thing that got me off my butt was we were leaving the place where I had been feeding women, and I was trying to get my 4-year-old in the car seat. And have you ever tried to get a 4-year-old in the car seat where they do that Olympic strength back arch? It's amazing. It's like, you know, like you're pushing with all your weight, and they're just like, never! And he was looking up as I was trying my pregnant self to get him in the seat, and there we were in front of a strip club, and the woman on the sign in front of the strip club was dressed like a cat, but it was a really scantily clad outfit, and she was smiling to beat the band. And he goes, "Mama, why is that lady smiling?" And the question really broke my heart. And it broke my heart because I thought, you know, someday that little boy's not going to ask that question. It's going to seem completely normal to him that we dress adult women up as cats and probably sell them as a commodity for less than you can get a cat. And that idea that had been percolating in my head was like, I'm going to do something different, and I want him to really know what it means to love women and honor women and be a part of women's strength and voice. So did that, and we started, and it took about 2 years to open up the first house, got a board together, and we had opened up the first house on the same street I lived on. I didn't want anybody to say not in my backyard, so I basically did it in my backyard, and it just went from there.
Awesome. And you mentioned your dad being an Episcopal priest, and you mentioned that also this afternoon. Tell us a little bit more just about your journey to the priesthood. Did you always see yourself becoming a priest?
And oh, you're so young, Meredith. Back in my day, women weren't priests.
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
No, I did not imagine myself as a priest growing up.
Oh, yeah, the acolyte thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first woman I met that was a priest, I was just graduating high school. She was the first woman ordained in Tennessee, Lucy, Sister Lucy up on the mountain. And she was a nun, too, at the same time. So I didn't, in my head, I'm still thinking, well, that's not an option. that ship sailed a long time ago. So sadly, right? But anyway, that's another story. But what happened, I was a math major, and I decided I wanted to move to D.C. and advocate for legislation through Bread for the World for feeding hungry kids. So it was an illogical path I was already following. But I loved math, I just couldn't think of anything I wanted to do with it. And I did that, and I realized that politics wasn't my thing either. And by that time, you know, women were going to seminary and getting ordained. So I got ordained. I went to seminary in 87 and got married in 88 and then got ordained in 91.
I'm Meredith Day, and this is Theology Live. This evening, I'm with entrepreneur, author, and Episcopal priest, the Reverend Becca Stevens. We are discussing her work with Thistle Farms, the social enterprise she founded in 1997 in Nashville, Tennessee. So, Becca, we've known each other for a couple of years now, and I talked about Becca was the priest at the Episcopal Chapel, we're not really a parish, in Nashville before I got here. And whenever I think of you, Becca, I think about your love of oils.
I love oils.
Yes, you love oils.
I love them.
Like, when you give Becca Stevens a hug, you smell, like, whatever was the most recent oil that you But I remember this because oftentimes in the chapel at St. Augustine's, the baptismal font that, you know, sits at the front of the chapel would be filled with oil instead of water. And our friend Jackson Hearn, he learned this the hard way because one day he walked in and put his finger in there and he left a really unfortunate 2 stains on his T-shirt, oil stains. And so the women of Thistle Farms, they are producing these healing oils and lotions and things that are meant to give peace and healing and offering to other people. So what does it mean that they're making these products and simultaneously experiencing healing within themselves?
Well, I feel like you just answered it.
But yeah, what
does it mean?
Like, what brought you to wanting to do, okay, we're doing this work of healing.
Right.
Why is this what you sell?
Well, you know, I mean, oils are significant in about any world religion for any time. I mean, you look at scripture, there's 425 passages where oils are used. I mean, it's a common thing to use oils. That is a beautiful thing. It's one of our sacramental rites. And what I've always felt like was that we kind of left the oils out of them as we progressed in that sacrament where people now just get a drop of them. And we forget that the oils themselves are really healing. And also, like any good sacrament, it's worth a lot of money if you market it well. And so, I'm just saying. It's a reusable product. It has high margins in the marketplace. It has a long shelf life. It's a really, really good product. So I love it when, I mean, I think sometimes I was born for the place where kind of arts and crafts and justice come together. It's a really sweet spot for me. And creating oils fits into that sweet spot. So, you know, all the oils that we use are part of the whole idea that all of creation is made for healing, that we don't need to leave things out, that we need to look around us and see what we can use and how we can blend it and how we can honor it and value it. That's the whole point of what we are. And if you're talking about Thistle Farm specifically, about that product, you know, early on when I realized that 100% of the women that I work with have been raped. Imagine that being the circle in the workforce that you're a part of every day. There are women with deep, deep trauma. Not just that manifest themselves in addiction, but manifest themselves with a lot of shame and still self-loathing. And to remember you're worthy is a beautiful thing. So to make something like an essential oil that's really expensive and to be able to anoint your own body, that is a beautiful, beautiful thing. And then to be able to offer it to somebody else and say, I am finding this healing. You can find this healing. You know, I've never thought that healing was, you know, this magic trick that people do. It's not a miracle cure. It's not like somebody just says, I'm well and you're sick, I touch you, boom, it's done. It is this grace that we practice every day that is practical and relevant and sacramental. And oils seem like a good way to capture that. And I think we got it wrong in a lot of levels in the institutional church about how we view healing. And the idea that you know, just priests are going to blend these oils and then dole them out to people, to me, felt like you were missing a huge part of the sacramental way oils have always been used. So, like, one of the things that happens is Thistle Farms blends oils for about 3 or 4 dioceses now. So the idea that women who have been through hell and who have come into a sense of healing in their own lives offer these oils for whole institutions to be able to use is a beautiful thing. I mean, that makes sense to me theologically.
So some people here, I was looking at our notes here and our LaCroix, like, coaster, large coaster here. Some people in the room might be surprised to learn that Thistle Farms is not the only social enterprise that you work with. You also are involved in something called the Welcome Project. Will you tell us about that?
Sure, and I'm not mad that you called this huge welcome mat a coaster, by the way. that I spent a year making, but go, it's okay. And what they are is about close to 2 years ago, I was walking in the woods in the Tetons, and I'd seen the video of the women who were coming off the boats, who were fleeing the genocide in Syria and coming to Greece into the refugee camps, and about how, you know, the response to how long they were going to be there, maybe an average of 17 years. Women were coming with babies, women were coming pregnant. And the link between refugees and human trafficking is huge. There's 12,000 young women missing from the refugee camps this past couple years. You know, fleeing the violence and degradation and fear of war is horrific, but you can't flee the violence and vulnerability of the poverty that you experience as a refugee. And I was thinking about how the Episcopal Church's whole moniker is, the Episcopal Church welcomes you. And that video was in my head, and I was walking in the woods, and I was like, we could make something out of those life vests. Wouldn't it be fun to weave those life vests into welcome mats? And so last April, we got funding, and we went into Ritsona, which is a refugee camp about an hour and a half out of Athens. It's an old, bombed-out military camp. Not bombed out, just probably just deserted, but it's like half walls, you know, big pit in the middle where something used to be. And we went there, and we got to invite 9 women to start a justice enterprise, the first one of its kind in Greece for women. And the folks there said, you can't hire 9 women, there'll be a riot. You can't pay refugees. And so we went in and we hired 9 women and we started paying refugees, which is a gift, right? When you realize, like, we can do this. And, you know, we used the blankets. These are the actual blankets that they got from the UNHRC when they landed. These are the strips of the life vests. And they started stripping the life vests into small pieces, and they started telling stories, you know, about just the horrors that they had gone through and these traumatic images that could be transformed into something really beautiful and life-saving. We've sold over $100,000 worth of mats. And more than $70 goes directly back to the women in the camp, $70 out of the 100. A lot of the money gets, the other part of it gets, you know, for staffing, for shipping, for tariffs, for all of that has to be paid out of it. But it's an amazing gift. And 5 of the original 9 women, we first started selling mats in July. So that's, I can't do that kind of math, but it's, I used to could have.
9 months-ish.
5 of the 9 women have been reunified with their husbands who had left earlier in Switzerland and Germany. So it's family reunification with moms and kids. And they run it. They pay, you know, we pay one sum. They distribute the money. They've trained the new women. They have 2 weavers in Greece, 2 men who provide the looms and do all the trading. And they're now learning how to weave really intricate things. And they get certificates. So it's actually a skill set when they finally land somewhere. They're actual weavers now. So it's a huge gift. And it's been, oh gosh, it's been such a learning curve for me to start this enterprise in the midst of a refugee crisis. It's been humbling. It's been inspiring. I've eaten food that I have never tasted before and fallen in love with. I mean, a million different experiences, all from the way it's always been. A few women sit around, whether it's at Thistle and Bee or whether it's in the Ritsona refugee camp. When women sit around and do an activity together, the stories flow and the healing begins.
Yeah, that's a lot more meaningful than a coaster.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I apologize to those 9 women. That's rough. All right. We're nearing the end of our time, but I think my last question for you, and you mentioned the Thistle, and we do have Thistle and Bee here, which is a wonderful sister organization to Thistle Farms. And I have this bumper sticker that says, I'm a Thistle farmer. I don't even know if do y'all make those anymore? Do y'all send those out?
Sometimes,
every once in a while. But what does it mean to be a Thistle farmer? And in this current sort of moment for a lot of us, and you mentioned today, and it's hard to not be mindful of the many crises that are going on in our world and in our country, and even in our city of Memphis today. How do we become thistle farmers in Memphis?
Well, you are a thistle farmer, Meredith. First of all, y'all should know that, you know, one of the great gifts, again, of doing this work is just the community you get to be a part of and meeting people that love you and want to support the women and the work. It is the biggest, most bestest gift I've ever had. It's the way that now I understand the gospel, that is rooted in love and people coming together, not in spite of their brokenness, but because of their brokenness, and finding deep meaning and wholeness and love. And when Meredith walked into the chapel, I knew I was falling in love. And I think you are a great thistle farmer, and I'm so excited about your priesthood and your life. It's all a great, great gift. And that's how I feel about so many people in this room who have been on this journey with us, is that y'all are thistle farmers. And to me, I wish more and more for all of us that our justice work was our worship. You know, that this was the altar cloth, that thistles were on the altar, that we built shelters like cathedrals, that, you know, we saw all the beautiful ways that we loved each other as our worship. And to me, thistles embody that perfectly. They are the great last wild weed out where the women are walking and sleeping and turning tricks. They do have a history of survival by brutality. They do have beautiful purple deep centers. And to me, once you become a thistle farmer, you're reminded that there were no weeds in Eden, that even thistles have great healing properties. You can use the extract in oil. It's good for your liver and for trauma. And when you're a thistle farmer, you don't really have to claim anything as your own. You can go anywhere in the world and pick thistles, and nobody will stop you. They are the truth of the gospel, that the harvest is plentiful, the laborers are few. The way we see it at Thistle Farms is you can talk any youth group once into going out and harvesting thistles. And so it's an evangelical tool because you have to continue to find new youth groups that don't know about thistles. But they're great. You know, you can turn the down of a thistle into a beautiful piece of paper. We just had a group yesterday at Thistle Farms where you saw seven beautiful college students from Mars Hill weep in a circle with women and share some of their own hashtag Me Toos. And then go downstairs and take the down of a thistle and turn it into a beautiful piece of paper that becomes valuable and beautiful. And that's what I hope that we all see in our lives, is those thistle parts of us. We all got it. If you think you don't have it, that is so funny to me. It's good to know what our thistle parts are and to remember what the down part is and what is so beautiful and at our heart, and that we don't have to compromise it. We can celebrate it. And when we can come together in love without judgment, we can, you know, grow and be powerful like a thistle. I mean, one thistle can propagate 1,000 more thistles. And as we take our faith and our love into the world in that kind of powerful way, there is nothing we cannot do. We can build cathedrals for people who are on the streets. We can build powerful justice enterprises. And we can keep spreading the truth that in the end, love is the most powerful force for change that there is. Thank you.
Please join me. At the start of Lent, a few short weeks ago, I imposed ashes during all-school chapel at Grace St. Luke's. The children marched down the aisle, and one by one, they looked up at me with big, beautiful eyes as I smudged a black crucifix in the center of their perfectly polished foreheads. Remember, you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Near the end of the line stood a boy in kindergarten, hesitantly inching towards me. I crouched down and met his eyes, asking, "Would you like for me to give you ashes?" "Well," he paused, "will it hurt?" It was only then that it occurred to me that placing ashes on foreheads could be frightening to a child. especially one who has been warned to steer clear from scorching surfaces, curling irons, cooktops, fires, and their residue. But his question remained curiously perceptive. The Lenten season is a time when we come face to face with ourselves, as if we are peeking through a pair of binoculars and our blurry vision quickens to focus, exposing our many shortcomings, scars, and fears. And he's right, it does hurt a little. But although the journey into the wilderness is not without heartache, it is indeed the pathway to hope. Theology Live is a ministry of Grace St. Luke's Episcopal Church, a welcoming community of faith in the heart of Midtown Memphis. This episode of Theology Live was engineered and edited by Mr. Noah Glenn, who also composed our theme music. We offer special thanks to our hospitality coordinators, Ms. Kathleen Hansen and Ms. Nikki Glenn, our visual artist, Mr. Josh Colfer, and Ms. Debbie Balling and the entire staff at Calvary Episcopal Church for hosting us during their annual Lenten preaching series. Of course, we also offer much gratitude to our guest this evening, the Reverend Becca Stevens. Join us back at our home location of Crosstown Concourse on April 12th as I interview Rabbi Micah Greenstein, Senior Rabbi at Temple Israel here in Memphis. Visit us at 901theology.com and follow us on Twitter at 901theology or on Instagram at Theology Live for updates about our episodes and events. If you have not already, subscribe to Theology Live on your preferred podcast platform, then help enhance our digital visibility by reviewing us on iTunes. Thanks for listening.